Last month, movie producer Tyler Perry spoke about the impact of being sexually abused as a young child on a special two-part Oprah program.
It's hard for me to look at those pictures because I feel like I died as a child.
You know, it's hard to listen to him even say that, which is part of the problem and part maybe why it's not discussed more often. Sexual abuse of boys and men long has been a taboo subject, cloaked in stigma and shame. Now male survivors and their advocates are beginning to speak out about the lifelong impact of sexual abuse and their hopes for recovery. Tyler Perry talked about that last month on Oprah. Later this hour, we'll talk with an OSU law professor working to make the legal system more responsive to victims of sexual violence, and we'll hear the personal testimony of a male survivor. Right now, we welcome to the show psychologist Howard Fradkin. He is a founder, past president, and now a member of the advisory board of directors of the nonprofit organization Male Survivor. Welcome to the show, Dr. Fradkin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Last month, you were invited as well to speak on the program, the Oprah Winfrey Show, as an expert on sexual abuse of boys and men. This is something you think about every day. Where do you start when you have an opportunity to reach that many people at once?
It was a tremendous honor and very exciting to be on the show and to have the opportunity to speak to millions of men and their partners and their family members to help any man know that it's okay to speak the truth about being abused.
I didn't know what to expect when I tuned in. I actually watched it online after the fact. Didn't know what to expect. And then they brought out the 200 survivors together all at once. And the emotional impact of that, I wasn't prepared for. That's really what it's all about, is being out there together.
It was a historic moment to bring 200 survivors together. The producers did a phenomenal job in terms of supporting all those men, and that all those men had that much courage. One of our panelists today is one of those men who was willing to speak his truth on the show. And to have everybody together just created such this intense bond of safety and support. And our goal was to let men know across the world that they're not alone.
Do you have any sense about what the impact of that program was? Those 2 days, it was two consecutive weeks.
The sense I have is that there are thousands of men, maybe millions of men, who are speaking their truth. Many of them for the first time. We've gotten responses from Europe, from Africa, from all over the United States. A lot of women were touched by the show as well, who are survivors.
Let's talk about the scale of the problem and the incidence of it. It's not quite as high. It's one in six.
One in six men have been reported to have been sexually abused before the age of 18. When you add in men who have had inappropriate sexual relationships or emotional incest, as it's called, or being exposed or other kinds of non-contact abuse, it actually goes up to one in four men.
Which is equivalent, basically, what?
25%.
25%.
Yeah, which is the same as what they say for women who've been abused.
Let's hear from the Oprah program when she asked Tyler Perry how he felt since talking publicly about his sexual abuse as a child.
I feel lighter.
Really?
I feel lighter as if I took the weight of the world off my shoulders. And I'm hoping that in talking about it, that it's helping a lot of other men to be free, because there are so many of us who don't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I feel a lot lighter.
It was a big deal when Oprah Winfrey herself came out and said that she had been sexually abused as a child. How big of a deal is it when someone like Tyler Perry does it?
Well, I think it's a huge deal. It's a huge deal that he's as public as he is, that he's an African-American man. So he gave a lot of permission to men of color to be able to speak. And I just think because he's such a big, broad, proud man, it gives a lot of courage to all men to know that they can speak and that they will be heard and they will be supported and understood.
I think what was interesting for me emotionally was that he still is grappling with the trauma.
Well,
it's not as if it's a done deal. And now I can come out and talk about it.
Right. For most men and women, it's a lifelong struggle. It gets better. It gets better and better and better. The more you talk about it, the more support you have. But it's a struggle. And coming out publicly is a huge deal. It took a tremendous amount of courage for every one of the men in that room to be there.
My guest is psychologist Howard Fratkin. He is a founder, past president, and a member of the advisory board of directors of the nonprofit organization Male Survivor. He appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show last month to talk about the incidents of sexual abuse of boys and men and the taboo subject that it has become over the years, or maybe not have become. It always has been taboo. Why is that?
Men are not supposed to be victims. Men are always supposed to be in control, especially in sexual situations. And so for a man to be victimized, it's a very shameful thing. It's a very embarrassing occasion in their life, and it's very difficult to talk about because they believe that they should have taken care of it. They should have controlled it. They should have stopped it. And, of course, they were victimized. They were vulnerable, and they weren't able to stop it. It's never a victim's responsibility, but it's very difficult for men to understand that and to really accept that truth for themselves.
There's been so much change in how we embrace women who have been sexually abused, either as a child or as an adult. Why didn't that same empathy or sympathy, I should say, carry over to men?
Well, a lot of it is because men have been so reluctant to speak. And so there hasn't been the opportunity because men have stayed in the shadows, stayed in silence, and haven't had that courage and haven't had that permission. And I think today, through a number of organizations, including Male Survivor, One in Six, and many others, there now is a lot more permission for men to speak that truth, and that's beginning to change the public's perception. And we're certainly hopeful that the Oprah Show was another huge way to communicate that message.
We'll have links to Male Survivor and other organizations on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, so you can get more information about all of that. If you want to talk with our guest, Dr. Howard Fratkin, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your comment or question there. We welcome any avenue, 614-292-8513, if you would like to talk to Dr. Fratkin. How did it occur to you as a psychologist that this was an area of need?
I just had many, many clients who kept coming to me. I'm a survivor myself, so I was attuned to that. In addition to that, it became more and more of an issue. I specialize in working with people with addictions, with chemical dependency, with sexual addiction, problems with relationships. I work a lot with people in the gay, lesbian community, and many of those folks have been more proportionately abused. And so it just was becoming more and more of an issue, and it was very important for me to do what I could as an advocate and as a supporter to make the conditions right so that people could speak.
How do you treat, as a psychologist, as a therapist, men differently than men? Is it the same sort of avenue of treatment?
It's the same avenue. The differences are that men have learned to shut down their feelings. We're supposed to be intellectual. We're supposed to be strong. And so it's much more difficult to give ourselves permission to have feelings, especially those feelings of pain. I mean, Tyler on the show was a good example of how difficult it was for him to feel like he had to control those emotions, and yet he had to let them out because that's the only way you can heal. And so it's a lot of permission giving that makes treatment with men different than women.
614-292-8513. I know you're listening out there. If you want to talk, give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about some of the myths that you would love to dispel, if you could. What would be the number one?
Well, the number one is that men can't be victims. So absolutely, men can be victimized, and men can be victimized by men. And another myth is that women are not perpetrators. And the truth is there are many perpetrators who are women. And that's even more difficult for men to talk about because, again, they're supposed to be in control. And so when a woman abuses a man, the shame is immense.
And what about the aftermath of abuse? When you look at statistics from the other side of the coin, when we're looking at statistics associated with pedophilia, often they were abused as children. And I'm doing the old air quotation marks there. But that's not necessarily, when you look at it from the other perspective, that everybody who is abused becomes a pedophile.
Exactly.
That's a myth.
Exactly. It is a myth. There is a small proportion of men who are abused who do go on to perpetrate others. Most perpetrators have been victims of some kind of abuse, be it sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, although even that's difficult to quantify because they don't want to talk about it either. But many of them, most of them, have been victimized themselves. Most victims of sexual abuse abhor the idea that they would perpetrate someone else.
If you could tell people one thing, if you could put out a plea to people and tell them one thing to get them to reach out and get the help that they need, I guess to make them want the help would be the first thing. But what would you say to them?
I just want men to know that healing is absolutely possible and achievable. A lot of men feel like they're stuck with this. It's just a big secret they have to keep inside. And I would like for all men in the audience to hear that it's absolutely possible to heal one step at a time, speaking the truth, getting support, learning new skills. They can heal.
I want to listen to Tyler Perry again from The Oprah Show. Here he's describing his first experience of sexual abuse as a young child by a neighbor.
I'm building a birdhouse, and, you know, he had his hands in my pants.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, what is this? And I felt my body betraying me because I felt, it's odd because I felt an erection at that age.
I thought that was important because that's a key to the guilt and the shame is with men, the overt, sometimes response that's not voluntary, but it's there.
Right, and it's a response that's physiological. It's not connected with feeling pleasure. It's not connected with wanting the experience at all. But perpetrators are very attuned to seeing that and then saying, see, this is what you want. You really want this. You really need this. And so it makes the boy very confused about, well, do I want it? Don't I want it? When the truth is, when they later on, they're able to go, no, that is never something that I wanted. I didn't want that experience at all. I wanted attention. And perpetrators are very attuned to picking men who need attention. Oftentimes they're people who are known to family members. So they entrust not only the parents but that child, and they teach them and groom them in a way that makes them able to manipulate this boy to get him very, very confused about, what do I want this? Don't I want it? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing?
The perpetrators sound absolutely diabolical.
Well, some are, but some are just men who are massively confused themselves, who, as we said a moment ago, have been perpetrated themselves, and they don't know how to heal. So some of them are diabolical. Some of them have no idea what they're doing. They're very dissociated themselves, and they're very cut off from themselves. Clearly what they do is very harmful in any event, and it's always wrong.
Is there any help for them?
Yes, absolutely. Perpetrators can get help, and our organization, Male Survivor, believes that it's very important that perpetrators get help and that they have as much access both to take responsibility for the perpetration as well as to deal with the underlying causes of their perpetrating, which oftentimes is their victimization.
With a reach the likes of the Oprah Winfrey Show, I was wondering if perpetrators did turn up in the mix of people affected by the message.
I would trust they did. I have not heard from any myself, but
okay.
I'm sure that they heard the message, and my hope is certainly that they heard how damaging their actions are. That's something that's very difficult for perpetrators to wrap their hands around.
Okay, we have to take a break right now. My guest is Howard Fratkin. He is founding board member of Male Survivor. He's a psychologist, and we're talking about the sexual abuse of boys and men and how it is a taboo, hopefully no more, and how advocates and survivors are beginning to speak out about the lifelong impact of sexual abuse and their hopes for recovery. If you have a question or comment, we welcome it, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
discover more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Learn about the latest in arts and culture in and around Columbus by visiting our website and clicking on Arts at the top of the page. On the WOSU Arts blog, you'll find reviews of the latest books, movies, local restaurants, and theater performances, along with insights from our classical music staff and more. Discover more about WOSU on our arts blog at WOSU.org.
Support for WOSU comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
23 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 29. A chance of some snow tonight, mostly cloudy, a low of 26 degrees. Some snow flurries for Friday morning and then cloudy skies and a high of 38. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guests, Howard Fradkin, founding board member of Male Survivor. We're talking about the sex abuse of boys and men. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513. Joining us now is Mark Spindelman. Mark is a professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law, where he teaches courses on the law and sexual violence. Mark also is on the board of directors of Male Survivor. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, I knew we weren't going to have time in that first segment to get to all of the myths, because all of the myths are part of what keeps people down and keeps people quiet, because they're sometimes the wall of myth is too hard to break through. And one of them is if you've been sexually abused by, if you're a man and or a boy and been sexually abused by a man, doesn't mean you're gay. It doesn't mean you become gay. Is that a common misconception? Dr. Fradkin?
It is a common misconception, and it's important that people understand that sexual orientation is determined early on by age 4 or 5, to the best that we understand it, and most abuse occurs after that. So what it does is it traumatizes a boy. It makes it much more difficult to figure out what his sexual orientation is, but it doesn't determine his sexual orientation.
And likewise, or on the other side of that, the perpetrator, if it's a male abusing a male, doesn't mean they're gay either.
That's right. Most perpetrators are not gay, and it's important for people to understand that when a perpetrator is abusing a boy, that's not sex. I don't call that sex. That's an act of violence. It's an act of abuse.
You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It's a touchy subject, and we want to talk about it now, so I hope you'll join us. Mark Spindelman, how do existing laws recognize sexual abuse or sexual violence when the victim is a boy or a man?
So the existing legal rules in lots of ways already contemplate or imagine or are capable of apprehending the problem of male sexual victimization, whether of a boy or of a man. In many instances, the laws are pretty much the same laws that exist that cover female sexual victimization, and they apply to boys and men as well.
And in practice, how does the legal system handle the cases then? Does it just is the system a victim of the myths and the misperceptions?
It's a great way of putting it. I think it absolutely is the case that the system is in lots of ways a victim of the myth. But to put it in a little different terms, the system, although it has rules on the books that are capable of apprehending the problem and dealing with the problem, there are many reasons and many ways in which the system doesn't actually in operation work to benefit or to help or to redress the harms that male victims, like female victims, suffer.
Children, nobody often, maybe, or at least increasingly they do, but one of the longtime problems was they didn't believe him. When a boy said he had been sexually assaulted, sexually abused, they weren't believed. Adult males, no one can believe they're complaining about it. It's that kind of a disbelief.
Sure. As hard as it is to imagine that a child, a boy, would be abused and wouldn't protect himself against the abuse, it's that much more difficult to imagine that there could be any adult man who would ever have sex against his will or ever have anybody aggress against him sexually without actually wanting it.
614-292-8513. And Bill, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann.
Hi, Bill.
I have been involved in prison ministries for several years, and in doing so, I hear some of the stories of the men in prison, and there's a significant portion of them that have been sexually abused, and they play out their abuse in the form of anger, and it could be rape or aggravated robbery or murder, and it winds up, puts them in prison. I wonder if your guests could talk a bit about the anger that's developed with these people that are subjected to this kind of abuse.
Dr. Fradkin?
Sure. Thanks for that comment, and you're right that the prisons are filled with male survivors of sexual abuse, and it's a tragedy that they weren't able to get the help that they needed so that they could have addressed a lot of that natural anger that comes out as a result of being abused. Some people bury that anger. Men are, in our society, given permission to be angry, and so they do use that anger in many ways to hurt other people because that's a way for them to feel more powerful. Sexual abuse is an act where power is taken away from someone, so the victim needs a way to be able to be powerful, and certainly one way to do that is to break the law, to transgress and be violent against other people. It's a tragedy that they don't get the help they need sooner.
Mark Spindleman, is that an accepted mitigating circumstance, or is that something when you're in you're being prosecuted for an unrelated crime, but it's triggered by, say, the anger and the dysfunction associated with the abuse? Is that something that's brought out in court very often, or has it traditionally not been?
Well, so ordinarily the commissions of crimes don't take into account sort of the crime of robbery, wouldn't make a special exception or circumstance for somebody who had been sexually victimized as a child. If it comes in at all, it would come in at the stage of sentencing, okay, of deciding sort of are there special circumstances that warrant some departure from the ordinary operation of the law. That would be the only place it would realistically come in. But it wouldn't constitute an excuse or a justification for engaging in otherwise criminal activity.
And even at the sentencing level, that would all assume that the abuse victim was telling anybody about it in the first place or was even aware of it and understanding the connection themselves.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of Bill, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. 614-292-8513. Karen, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I think with the situation that happened with my husband, the opposite happened as far as anger goes. I think it created in him from the time he was young, and after this had happened where a Boy Scout leader had sexually abused him. He never told anyone, not his family, later on in life, not his wife or children. As a second wife, he did tell me, but it was in his late 40s when he did. But I think it engendered in him a lack of confidence in himself, even though he's very much a man and an incredibly wonderful person. There was a lot of self-confidence that wasn't there, I believe, that was caused by that.
That's a very common problem that male survivors have, the issue of not feeling confident, not feeling strong enough to be able to speak, to be able to be effective at work, to be able to have natural, normal conflict with people, the difficulty with speaking. I'm glad that your husband was able to speak the truth to you, and that speaks well to your marriage, that he felt safe enough with you.
Well, I think safety is a very big thing. Now, how it came about with us was that I had tried to buy him some cologne one time, and he said that he didn't wear cologne, and then he told me that the reason why was the person who molested him had cologne on, and that's haunted him ever since, and he will not wear cologne. And, that was why that staggered me for a while, but we have such a good relationship, and there's such a comfort that he's gotten past it, and in his own mind, he's even forgiven the person who did this. But what a mess it made of his life for so long, and allowing others to just take advantage of him, to emotionally abuse him, and I'm just glad I've been able to come into his life and give him that support that he needs.
Speaking not as a law professor, but as a human being, it just thank you for sharing the story. It just is a reminder, or another reminder, of the ways in which just small details of our lives can reveal and contain a kind of significance beyond their obvious proportions, right?
Thank you.
And it really speaks to the power of love and how important that is in providing that kind of safety and support that survivors need.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have an email from a listener. They write, there was a more horrifying statistic on Oprah than the 1 in 6. It was that more than 80% of the men were abused by someone they knew or trusted. How do we get this kind of betrayal to stop?
Well, I tell parents that it's their job to teach their children that anytime they have a problem, anytime that they're concerned or scared or upset, or even if they do something wrong, that they can always come to their parents and tell them, and that the parents will listen and believe them and support them and not punish them. And unfortunately, what happens is kids get afraid to tell their parents, and so things are happening because oftentimes these perpetrators are doing a series of things that lead to the problem, and parents need to be aware that, unfortunately, these are people who oftentimes are known to them and seem to be trustworthy. And sometimes, you know, there are indications that they're problems. It's just that people aren't paying attention, and they need to really pay attention to especially changes in behavior that their children are engaging in. That's a big red flag.
Is it something that you can talk about in some ways before you even suspect there's a problem, just so that, because you don't know?
It's really important to talk about safe touch, you know.
When
they're very young, what makes a touch safe and what makes it not safe, that a child should always feel comfortable with themselves. And if they feel scared, then they should be able to tell somebody that, I feel scared, I don't feel safe.
When I was preparing for the show last night, my own boy wanted to know what I was doing, and I told him. He's 14 and a half, almost 15. I told him exactly what the show was going to be about, and I said, and by the way, if there's anything you want to tell me, we talked about that at length, the whole idea of talking about stuff like that, and we've talked about it before, but this was much more direct, because I figured at the age of 15, who knows, you know, what they've seen on television. I can't imagine talking about something like that would be untoward.
If I could, so one of the things that I think is in the question is a sense both of the urgency of the problem as well as a desire to do something active about it. I think that there are lots of ways that we can imagine people getting involved and trying to do something to address the problem. But as much as anything else, the conversations like this, which break the silence around its existence, may at this very moment be much more significant than some of the things that are sort of in my ordinary professional bailiwick, changes in law, lawsuits, this, you know, sort of really having the space in which to have an open, honest dialogue about some of these problems is really vitally important to doing something about it.
You know, talking about sexual abuse of boys, very often they're not able to talk about it at the time. It may take years, as Karen described, before they can acknowledge the abuse and sometimes seek legal recourse. And I was wondering, how does a statute of limitations work in most states? How much time do people have?
Yeah, just so let me say what a statute of limitations is. So the law has rules on the books that describe certain kinds of conduct as either criminal or tortious, meaning that some harm that the law will recognize is a compensable harm. Often, so we often think of this in the context of slip and fall cases, or right, somebody falls and then there's some lawsuit. But there are also other forms of injury that the law allows people to be compensated for. So those lawsuits often work in ways that sort of allow causes of action to be brought, but to get into court, what you have to show is that you're bringing the suit within the right amount of time. So there are legal rules, we call them statutes of limitations, that say if you have a cause of action that you want to bring and have it heard before a court, you must bring it within a certain period of time. Now, in many jurisdictions, there are statutes of limitations on sexual crimes or sexual injuries, which mean practically that victims have to bring their suit within a particular period of time. Now, there are different states have different statutes of limitations that operate in different sorts of ways. But what a number of male survivors, like their female counterparts, have found is that if they don't address or don't discover or don't deal with their sexual victimization early enough, soon enough, from a legal perspective, they may find themselves being willing to or interested in bringing a lawsuit or having a case criminally prosecuted, but find themselves out of luck in a sense because the statute of limitation says you missed your time.
Do you think that those laws should change, Mark, or is that something that's out there being worked on?
It is absolutely something that's being worked on, and you know, as The advocacy position is that the laws absolutely ought to be changed, that there are important reasons to understand that victims of sexual abuse have a certain set of difficulties, particularly something like male sexual victimization, but not only male sexual victimization, that male victims of sexual abuse, like their female counterparts, often have a great difficulty both coming to terms with and understanding the full dimensions of their injuries, and that the legal system ought to be much more sensitive to the realities of their lives and their healing processes than the statute of limitations written not with them in mind have been.
You know, let's talk about why it's important or not to prosecute the perpetrators. We've gone through years now of debate and acrimony and angst and a lot of expense with the Catholic Church and what they've gone through. Will it help people who are abused if they can prosecute or see their perpetrator or see their abuser prosecuted, and conversely, does it help the perpetrator?
Let me just take up part of it and then give part of the question to Howard, because I think he has an important perspective on this. So I think it's absolutely the case that the state ought to understand and see and address the problems that the victims of sexual abuse, whether male or female, experience. That is, the state has an obligation to police against private violence, including sexual violence, and absolutely ought to have its doors fully open to the harms that women and men, straight and gay, suffer by virtue of a sexual crime. That said, I think it's important to understand that as important as it is for the state to have its doors wide open to victims and survivors, much wider open than the state's doors have been up until now, it's also important to understand what it is that people are trying to achieve, whether it's through a criminal prosecution or whether it's through a civil lawsuit against a perpetrator or an institution that didn't do what it ought to have done to have protected the victims from having what happened to them happen. So as important as it is for the state to be sort of there, ready to respond, I think it's really quite important to understand that there may be limits on what can be achieved through lawsuits. Certainly the kinds of healing and hope that Dr. Fracken is talking about are not always achieved in court, which is set up often to place burdens of proof on victims that in many ways are widely known, mostly in the context of female sexual victimization, to constitute a kind of sexual assault on the victims, right? A second assault, a second rape is a familiar term. Mm-hmm. And so I think people really have to think very hard. And this is not to discourage anybody who wants to bring a suit from bringing a suit, but I think people have to really understand what they're trying to achieve through lawsuits and through legal recourse that ought to be available to them.
Howard Fracken, what do you think?
I think that bringing a suit could be healing, possibly. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, there's not much justice in the justice system. And because, as Mark has explained, it's so difficult to prove that survivors go into court. And what it takes to go into court is an immense amount of courage, because it's so painful and so difficult to expose. You have to expose your entire life, not just your abuse, but you're opening up your entire life and anything you've ever done or has been done to you to the public. And that's horribly exposing after you've already been violated to now be violated in a sense.
And it's not only opening it up, but to be questioned on it.
Exactly, to be questioned and pushed on it and doubted.
Right.
It's painful. It's difficult. And that's not very healing at all. I mean, it's important if you can speak your truth. Whether or not you'll be believed is another matter. And I tell people that there are many other paths to healing, and it's really important, regardless of whether you pursue a lawsuit. You have to pursue your own healing. You have to pursue your own forgiveness of yourself. And the other thing that happens is that that victims become very loyal to their perpetrators. And so I've had cases where somebody brought a lawsuit, they were successful, and then they felt terrible when the sentence occurred, because they felt that they'd hurt their perpetrator, because they really weren't prepared to be in court. And that's the problem with the statute of limitations. It forces people to go to court long before they're really ready.
And yet, if the perpetrator goes unprosecuted or escapes any kind of legal ramifications, they are free to continue abusing.
And most of them do continue abusing, yes.
Right. That's typical. Mark?
Yeah, I want to come back to one of the points that Howard was just making. So the legal system isn't entirely impotent to change sort of the structure of how these cases are brought and prosecuted, so that it might be the case that the ways in which victims find themselves open to and having to open their whole lives up, that doesn't have to be the case. There are legal reforms, including rape shield statutes, that the sexual victimization movement, mainly focused on women, have managed to successfully bring about. And other reforms could be brought so that it wouldn't be that the stakes of bringing a suit wouldn't be as high as they now are, and so that there might be more people who would be encouraged, or fewer people who would be discouraged from bringing suits by virtue of legal changes that we could work on.
That's Mark Spindleman. Mark is a professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law, where he teaches courses on the law and sexual violence. He's also on the board of directors of Male Survivor, and also with us, psychologist Howard Fradkin. He is a founder, past president, and now a member of the advisory board of directors of the nonprofit organization Male Survivor. We're talking about child sex abuse and adult sex abuse of men, and the stigma and the taboos associated with that. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're welcome, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we return, we'll meet a Central Ohio man who was raped as a teenager and how he's survived since then. Stay tuned. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, a history of the business of hip-hop from someone who was once part of the industry, Dan Charnas. His new book is about how hip-hop producers and entrepreneurs changed the music industry and popular culture and helped get hip-hop taken seriously.
Nobody thought that the stuff that was in the streets was even music. It was just stuff that people did at parties.
Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher online at WOSU.org/allsides. You can listen to new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. You can also find All Sides on Facebook and Twitter, subscribe to podcasts, and preview upcoming programs. Discover more about WOSU and All Sides with Ann Fisher at WOSU.org/allsides.
Support for WOSU comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment consultants helping clients achieve financial independence through professional planning at sherringtongroup.com.
23 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine today, and a high of 29. A chance of some light snow tonight, cloudy skies, a low of 26 degrees. Morning snow flurries for Friday, cloudy skies in the afternoon, and a high of 38. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about the sexual abuse of boys and men and how the stigmas and the taboos surrounding that have exacerbated the damage over the years for so many hundreds and hundreds and thousands and millions of men and boys over the years. And joining us today is Howard Fradkin. He is a psychologist, and he's founder and past president, and now a member of the advisory board of directors of the nonprofit organization Male Survivor. Howard, thanks again for being with us today.
Thank you, Ann.
And also Mark Spindleman. He's a professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law, where he teaches courses on the law and sexual violence. Mark also is on the board of directors of Male Survivor. Thanks again, Mark, for being with us today.
Thanks for doing the show, Ann.
Oprah, we kind of were spurred or inspired to do the show last month when Oprah Winfrey put together, well, had two special programs on the topic. Her producers put together the stories of some of the victims. Here are a few of the voices of some of the 200 men who gave witness to their sexual victimization that day on the program.
I work for child welfare.
I work for the federal government.
The sexual abuse started when I was
sexually
four.
Assaulted at 16.
I was raped at the age of 14.
I was 6.
I was 12.
I was 7.
I was sexually abused my entire childhood until I was 18.
That is something that you can see online if you want to go online. We'll have a link to those programs on our website at WOSU.org. One of those people there that day is Rob Berger. He is an attorney employed by the state. He was raped as a teenager, and we want to welcome him to the show and tell him how much we appreciate his willingness to talk about his abuse and his recovery process. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thank you.
Tell us what happened and what's happened since.
All right. When I was a teenager, I got to know a Catholic priest. I'm not Catholic myself, but I got to know a Catholic priest because he hosted a group for people who were gay to come together and try to talk about issues related to being gay. And this is back in the early 80s, so the world was a little bit different place back then as far as being gay. And that is how I met him. And we became friends, and I remember there was one time I was at his home, the rectory, and we were having a drink, I don't know, iced tea or soda or something. I remember sitting on the couch having this drink, talking with him, and the next thing I remember is I woke up and I was lying on the floor, and my pants were down, and he was performing oral sex on me.
So he drugged you?
Yes. I have no other explanation for it. I have never discussed it with him, but right. I mean, there would be no reason for me to pass out.
What happened after that?
Well, I did what a lot of men and boys do when they find themselves in that situation. I completely repressed it. I told myself it didn't happen, that it didn't matter, that it didn't harm me, that I wasn't a victim, and I buried it very deep within my psyche and chose not to deal with it.
And yet you were one of the 200 that were on the Oprah Winfrey show that day, that making the point that this has affected my life. How did it affect your life?
Well, until I dealt with it, when I was in my 30s, I went to see a therapist to figure out why I couldn't have a successful romantic relationship. And believe it or not, it never occurred to me that being raped might have – I had denied it so deeply that I didn't even think that that would have an impact. And through going through therapy, I've learned a lot and grown a lot. Before I went to therapy, basically the way that I dealt with it was that I denied it, and I – did a lot of binge drinking that I think was sort of some self-medication for the stress that was caused by it. Also, I pretty much avoided any sort of meaningful romantic attachments and was not successful in that area. So it made intimacy and trust very difficult.
Was it difficult to find a therapist to work with on this?
You know what? I live here in Columbus, and I feel very fortunate. There is an abundance of opportunities for therapy here in Columbus, and so I was able easily to find somebody who could help me and who would understand my issues. I think depending on where you live, there may be a challenge to find someone who could understand your issue and help you, but I was lucky.
When in the course of therapy, you remembered what had happened and went through it again by remembering it again. How long after that were you able to, what was the trauma of going through it again, I guess?
Well, it's funny because when I went into the therapy, of course, I didn't go in to deal with
this issue.
But I kind of imagined the therapy as being this beautiful, painless experience that all things wonderful blossom out of. And what I discovered was it was a lot of painful, difficult work. Now, it was worth it, and I would do it all over again. But it was very challenging and painful, if only because I had buried it so deeply. I remember when I was first being counseled, my therapist was trying to get me to acknowledge the fact that it had caused me pain, or because when I talked about it, it was completely emotionless. And he gave me an assignment and told me he wanted me to write a letter to my perpetrator and bring it back in. And I went home. I wrote the letter. I was really – first draft, I'm like, this is perfect, but absolutely no emotional response to it. And I went for my next session, and I explained to him what I had done. I brought my letter. I did the task. And he asked me to read the letter. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't read it because that was breaking down that wall. That was acknowledging the realness of it by using my lips to say those words. And that's, I think, when I grasped the depth of my denial and repression.
It was a Catholic priest. What did you do? Did you ever go to prosecute? Did you ever do anything to turn him in?
After I had completed my therapy, was around the time that all of the scandals around the Catholic Church and the priests had been covered in the news, and it got me thinking about the fact that he could still be doing this to other people, and I did contact the church and made them aware of it. He initially denied it and tried to suggest that I had somehow done something to him or, you know, But it's my understanding he's since been removed.
When you say done something to him, you mean provoked it.
Well, and I'm trying to remember exactly. It seems like his initial response was to the church, as relayed to me, was it didn't happen and he stole money from me.
Oh, that I bet you is pretty common from perpetrators.
It is pretty common that perpetrators refuse to take responsibility. Absolutely.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the conversation, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Rob, going on the Oprah Winfrey Show is a huge step. It would be for anybody for anything, let alone this. How did you decide to do something like that and be public about it? It's one thing to acknowledge it and go through the work that you've gone through to live with it, but...
Well, it's been my experience in trying to get past this and deal with it, process it, therapeutically release it, whatever you want to call it, that talking about it is key. And I thought that this would be an opportunity to talk about it. Also, at the time that the opportunity to go on the show came up, I had never told my family. And I knew that if I agreed to do the show, I would absolutely have to tell my family. And I kind of wanted something to push me in that direction because I had been making excuses for many years of why. You know, the time just wasn't right to do it. So, talking about it, it definitely is a healing part. I told a number of people I work with about the fact that I was going to participate in the show, and it was amazing to me. The reception that I got was 100% positive from speaking with individuals, and a significant percentage of them related their own personal stories about being abused themselves.
Your family, how'd they respond?
Positively. I think that it was a big load of information to present. I went into it. My only goal was to tell the story. I wasn't expecting anything positive or negative. I didn't need anyone to do anything for me or to say anything to me. I just wanted to share the information. So I had pretty limited expectations, but it was positive. I'm glad that I did it, and it was the right thing to do.
Christina, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having the show. Oh, I'm a little choked up. It's very moving. Especially thanks to the survivor for. Excuse me.
It's okay.
He's really brave. These are some really brave people that come out about it because the way our culture is and the way it treats boys and the way it makes them be or insists that they be is just so poisonous. And it just doesn't do them any favors, and they have to be tough all the time, and they're not supposed to show their feelings. And so many times in the media, we have the stereotype of the guy as this, oh, just this unfeeling dolt. He'll be fine, whatever, you know. And so they never get to really express themselves, and they can't admit this stuff because of the stigma. So I think if we can change somehow our culture to be more accepting of boys in that way as, you know, human beings, you know, just like girls are, human beings with feelings. And I don't think we do that enough.
It seems like it's still the girls chat and the girls talk and girls have their big groups and they chat and I have all my girls. But it seems like boys, Dr. Fradkin, still are somewhat isolated from each other.
They are isolated, and they do keep to themselves, except when they're talking about sports or the weather or manly things, hunting. One of the things that the show pointed out, that the Oprah show pointed out, and that I'm involved with male survivors leading weekends of recovery, and what we found is that when men have an opportunity to form a community and a bond with other men, their healing amplifies many times, because now they feel like they're people who understand, they're people who get me, they're people who are telling the same story. And all those men on the Oprah show, I'm sure Rob would agree, felt that bond and that there was, we're not alone, and that there are people here who get me and understand me and support me. And it's a great way to heal and recover.
Rob, what was it like to be with all these other guys that had their own stories but shared that one?
It was a mixture of positive and negative. It was joyous, it was overwhelming, but it was also painful, because it stirred up not only all of your feelings and experience, but you were getting other people's as well. And that's a good and a positive thing, but it also creates emotional turmoil. So it was an amazing experience, though. I'm glad that I did it, but it was very intense.
How did you prepare to do something like that? Did you talk with, I don't know, did people, were they prepared? Did someone talk to you beforehand about what's going to happen? And
going into the show, we had a general idea of how it was going to proceed, but I didn't do anything to prepare, and so it was kind of like a roller coaster ride. And then when I got home, the great irony was, before I went to the show, I was excited about the opportunity, if only just because you're going to be on Oprah, you know,
right,
and get a free trip to Chicago. And so I was telling everyone because I was excited, and then when I got back, I didn't want to talk about it, and it took some effort for me to get comfortable, because I knew I'd set all these people up and they're all going to say, how did it go? What happened? And I felt like going back into my cave and sort of withdrawing. So that was a challenge.
When they all held up the pictures of themselves, you know, and when you held that picture up, that was very troubling, because it spanned the waterfront in terms of ages almost. Did that matter to you, that you had to dig that picture up and look at yourself again?
The experience of seeing all of those pictures was very emotionally powerful, because you realized it allowed you to see the person that was being sexually abused, not the person that's before you, but the innocent child that was exploited and taken advantage of.
That is all the time we have. I want to thank Rob Berger for joining us today. Rob was on the Oprah Winfrey Show last month two programs devoted to the topic of sexual abuse of men and boys. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Also, Mark Spindelman. Mark is a professor at OSU Moritz College of Law, where he teaches courses on the law and sexual violence. Mark, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks.
And Dr. Howard Fradkin, he's founder, past president, and now a member of the advisory board of directors of the nonprofit organization Male Survivor. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for this historic time.
Appreciate it. We have all those links that you need on our website. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.